Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a prison.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, I guess now Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, we appreciate your amazing support. Thank you so much. You want to connect with us, the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggressions. And I'll tell you, we really do appreciate the partnership that we have with our sponsors. They've been fantastic. They helped to make this show go. And so what we tried to do is find sponsors that make sense. Chemical Free Body has been with us since I think we started. Tim James is fantastic. He's been on the show multiple times. I fully recognize that the vitamin industry is filled with grifters and scammers and products that don't work. So that's why I'm so appreciative that I found Tim, that we found Chemical Free Body. And they're making the best stuff out there. I know. I've been on it for 2 years. It's fantastic. I'll tell you what, they built a landing page for us. If you are interested, you can go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro and just check out what they've got. They set up a new program for first-time buyers. You can get 20% off the first time you buy. So definitely load up on whatever you find first time around. Use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself some money. We do appreciate them and Chemical Free Body for being involved with us. Also, our newest sponsor is Solar Power Lifestyle. They are veteran-owned, family-run business, a small business. They like the show. They listen to the show. We appreciate that. And what they're doing is they're selling solar panels from the smallest ones you can think of to the biggest ones they've got. And financing is available. There's fast, free shipping inside the continental United States. You can get there's a low price guarantee match. So if you buy something from them, find it cheaper somewhere else, they'll match your price. 30-day, no hassle return policy, all that good stuff. So take a look at it. See what you think. They've got all the big brands, EcoFlow, Jackery, whatever you're looking for, they probably have it there. If you just need extra power for your job site, or you want to put full panels on your cabin or your van or RV, whatever you're thinking of, you might as well go over there, take a look, see if they've got it. SolarPowerLifestyle.com, promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself a little bit of money. Well, I'm excited to talk to our guest about this, but I wish we were talking about something, I don't know, a little bit more cheery. This is the dark side of organized religion. I think we all fully recognize this. Derek Bros is the best in the business when it comes to investigating these things. You can catch his work over at The Conscious Resistance or The Last American Vagabond. It's my pleasure to have Derek Bros. Hey, Derek, how are you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're doing outstanding work. I wish you were writing about last week's opening day of football season, but instead, you're writing about LDS Church. You're writing about some really dark things that we know about. I've had Nick Bryant on before. He's talking about the Franklin scandal. I've had guys on talking about care homes in Australia and Canada. So this is unfortunately a topic that we're familiar with. And I feel like there's at least two different major stories going on here. We have this sort of long-term problem of the Catholic Church and an examination of the Mormon Church, I should say, and the Catholic Church too, let's be honest. But the Mormon Church, the examination of Gordon B. Hinckley and what he did during his sort of reign of terror. But then there's this secondary story that's a little bit more new, starting, I guess, this summer, talking about the ritualistic component to some of the abuse that was happening in the Mormon Church. And to nobody's surprise, The Last American Vagabond is covering both of these. So let's start back where the scandals really begin with Gordon B. Hinckley. He was the president from Mormon president from 1995 to 2008. And I'm not suggesting that he started the abuse. My guess is that it probably went deeper and longer than his reign, but he jumps out as a very interesting character. What do we need to know about Gordon B. Hinckley?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, he was the president of the Mormon Church until his death in 2008. And so for those who might not be aware, I mean, I wasn't aware till this summer when I started diving down this particular investigation back in June, which started with, as you mentioned, this announcement about ritualized sexual abuse. I started looking at different elements. Okay, what's going on in Utah in general? What's happened in the church? And so there was several different components. And, I got a lowdown on really Mormonism and the state of Utah. I mean, for those who might not remember your American history, you know, Utah being settled kind of Wild West. Well, a lot of the folks that settled it were Mormons, were escaping religious persecution. And that, you know, kind of has stayed that way over the last couple hundred years. The Mormons essentially run the state. Most of the people in political positions, law enforcement positions, school boards, et cetera, you know, are to one degree or another involved in the church. And this, you know, I will say, because I've said this at every interview, just so people don't seem to take it the wrong way, but reports are not an attack on the Mormon church itself. Although I will say that the more I learn about it, the more I'm convinced that it probably is a cult. And I would say that after having interviewed dozens and dozens of current and former members, some who feel that same way, who like say, hey, I still follow Jesus. I think I'm they might call themselves Mormon, but they now look at the church as like something, you know, totally different. So just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
Gordon B. Hinckley in the church, he's not just president. They're known as prophets as well. So that's important to understand too, is that when they're in that position, they're not necessarily Jesus or God, but they're somewhere more than human. You know, they're seen as kind of infallible and things like that. So that's something else to recognize. And so when you want to make accusations against a person of that stature, you're bound to get some, you know, knee-jerk reactions and some criticism. And so, especially when it came to Gordon B. Hinckley, he really is seen as somebody who modernized the Mormon church. He was an apostle in the church before, like in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and at different positions up until the point in the 90s when he became president. So he was long-term, you know, known in the church for a long term, and again, seen like almost as something otherworldly to a lot of these people. But in a more practical level, he started to modernize the church in the sense of buying radio stations, buying TV stations. He helped them form this Bonneville International Media Corporation, something along those lines. And that corporation, if you look it up, they've actually produced shows for like Netflix and Amazon. It's, you know, essentially, and maybe in one way or another, Mormon propaganda, but a lot of people don't, you know, recognize the sort of rabbit hole that it goes, you know, where it comes from. And, under his leadership, also the Mormon Church started to buy up tons of properties. And this is, again, something I didn't know until I started to investigate it. So much attention has been paid to Bill Gates and the amount of land he owns, but actually the Mormon Church is one of the other top five landowners in the United States. Like that corporation of the LDS, they own land all across this country. And they, you know, they have different reasons for that. Some of those religious reasons where they think Jesus or their savior is going to come back and things like that. But overall, Gordon B. Hinckley is an extremely influential, extremely powerful person. And I basically started to investigate claims against him because I was sent, myself and Ryan, we were sent this tape, VHS tape from that was produced in the late 80s, early 90s. It hasn't ever made itself on the internet until we published it. And the title was just The True Story of Mormon President Gordon B. Hinckley. And I had a source reach out and basically say, hey, I have a copy of this tape. I don't think it's been seen by most of the public ever. It hasn't been seen by most people, you know, anybody who's seen it in 30 plus years. I'd like to, you know, send it to you. And this is because they noticed that people started to reach out to me once I started to report on what was going on in Utah and this investigation into ritual abuse. And then I started to talk about some of the history of the Mormon Church going back to the 1990s. And one of the church leaders, a man named Glenn Pace, he filed to the church leadership what became known as the Pace Memo, where he had conducted this two-year investigation. And according to Glenn Pace and his memo, which the church says was, you know, totally discredited, but depending on who you believe, he said that, you know, he found hundreds of examples of people within the church practicing what he called Satanism or some other, you know, something not Christian in his words. And that he said this had infected nearly every level of the church and was essentially warning about this. And yeah, so, I mean, there is a history going back in the Mormon Church to the more recent things people have heard about, like the polygamy with Warren Jeffs and some of that. That's like one of the sort of like offshoots of the main church. But the point is, like, there's a history that does exist. The Mormon Church very much tries to downplay this. And I think this is because during Gordon B. Hinckley's time, they went from, like, for example, even the documentary that we shared, when the people are being interviewed there, you can tell that Mormonism doesn't have the level of respect that it does now in the mainstream. Like, if you look, one of the top religions of the world, top five, is now Mormonism. It didn't used to be that way just 30, 40 years ago. It was still very much seen like a cult and like some sort of weird stepchild to Christianity. Whereas now the church has grown very massive. They have millions of followers around the world. And I think that is why they would seek to suppress some of these accusations against Gordon B. Hinckley.
Well, Hinckley was we can say what we want about him being a notorious monster, and he probably was. But like you mentioned, on the technology side, he was a visionary in a sense that he really got the, like you mentioned, like the shortwave radio, but also the television network, that Bonneville station. Now, it's funny, when I read that, I was like, I remember watching shows where at the very end it says this, you know, a Bonneville network, something or other. So that name rang a bell for me. I said, wait a second, I've never watched any Mormon related shows, but I know that name and I know that as a network. So it went out there, but that actually is quite fitting given that back in, well, he might've even been early, maybe even the Jerry Falwells and the Christian Broadcasting Network and the all these, I mean, if you're a high income preacher, you've got to have your own television network now. I mean, everybody sort of does that, but that worked to spread this message quite far. I did watch that video that they sent you, The True Story of Mormon President Gordon B. Hinckley. It's just a series of interviews with people that had access to information that they were either there or connected to a car dealership, right? Hunter brothers ran this car dealership. And from that car dealership, above the dealership, there was like an apartment and they would have parties there. But then the parties got too crazy for that place. So they bought their own house outside of that and funneled people back and forth. Let's talk about who these these Hunter brothers were, and they were partnered up with Hinckley at this car dealership for like parties and bringing kids and women. But they talked about prostitute women of all colors. They talked about young boys, 15 and 16. And then the one guy that was getting interviewed, the guy who claims to have had a sexual relationship with Hinckley, was talking about real graphic detail about what was going on. And he was in the process of dying from AIDS, right, when this video was filmed. So, I mean, a guy, literally like a deathbed confession from a guy who had been, I guess, excommunicated from the church earlier. So let's talk about like what this video showed and what was going on at this car dealership. Sounds like hell on earth, but again, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, there's a few moving parts here. So yeah, the videotape itself was put together by a team of people, but the main man was named Bill Clauden. He was a member of the Mormon Church as well, who also was excommunicated once he began investigating Gordon B. Hinckley. And at this time, at the time of the initial investigation, Hinckley was still an apostle, but he was on his way to becoming president. So they could already see that he was, you know, ascending to the throne, so to speak. And people were suspicious of some of his activities. And so on the short mini documentary, as you mentioned, it's interviews with different people. There's five different people, including Bill Clauden, the lead investigator. There's a man named Louis Sims, who worked at the Hunter Motor Car Lot, which is owned by the Hunter brothers, Walton and Alvin Hunter, who also were members of the church. And so what I was able to confirm is that Alvin and Walton Hunter exist, were real people. They're dead now, as is Gordon B. Hinckley. They did have a relationship. They were friends, you know, so we know that they did hang out. They definitely did indeed know each other. The Hunter Motor Car Lot did exist in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in Salt Lake City. It's no longer there. So that part we can confirm. And essentially, once I got the tape, you know, it was like, okay, this could potentially be something, but can I prove what this tape is saying, right? You know, I didn't want to just throw it out on the internet and say, here's, you know, a tape from 30 years ago. I don't know if it's true or false, but, you know, make of it what you will. Right. I mean, ultimately, that's what it comes down to. But we wanted to make sure that we, you know, actually tried to fact check as much of this as possible. And so I spent weeks going through, listening to the tape very carefully, writing down every name, every reference we could, making phone calls, emails, tracking people down. And the vast majority of the people associated with this are deceased. Louis Sims, the man who worked at the Hunter Motor Car Lot, who said that he helped get some of the prostitutes, some of the women that he knew from, I guess, his part of town or his other work. You know, he said he knew them. He died literally just months ago, a few months ago. So, you know, before I learned about this, unfortunately. One of the other men who was there and also witnessed it, we have been able to find him. We're pretty sure that he's deceased. Bill Clauden, the lead investigator, he died a couple years ago. A woman, Viola Gallo, who she was there at the parties as well. She's one of the people, they all describe seeing young boys, you know, so it just goes through each of their testimony. She died 4 or 5 years ago. I think some of her kids are still alive. I'm still trying to reach out to different people's family members just to see, hey, did dad or mom ever mention this, or any corroboration or things like that? But unfortunately, yeah, most of the people who are in the tape who say what they say have since passed. And I did talk to different sources who were, you know, not willing to come out publicly, but who claim to have some knowledge of this time period. And so essentially the story is that Alvin and Walton Hunter, members of the church, bishops in the church, the Mormon church, were buddies with Gordon B. Hinckley when he was an apostle. And as you mentioned, they had this apartment above their car lot, and they would have sex parties there, prostitutes, gay men, which, you know, 30 years later in the 2000s, not a huge deal, right? Obviously, as a Mormon man, conservative, that clearly not what he's promoting to be. But the big, you know, potentially criminal activity is the mention of young boys. Like, obviously, that's like, okay, this isn't just somebody buying some prostitutes and we, you know, shame him or whatever. But right, this is clearly some criminal activity being accused here. So everybody that is on the tape says that they witnessed this. There's one of them says that they saw, they remember one specific time, Gordon B. Hinckley going in the room with two young boys, 15, 16 years old. And as you mentioned, the man, Charles Van Dam, who did die of AIDS as well, claimed to have had a homosexual relationship with Gordon B. Hinckley, and that Gordon B. Hinckley excommunicated him, you know, to sort of get rid of him out of the church. So this tape was made. It was produced in the late 80s and started to be distributed around different churches in Utah in the 90s. From what I learned, there were probably up to some point 3,000, maybe 4,000 copies of this VHS tape, and they were distributed to friendly churches. But eventually, Gordon B. Hinckley's attorneys did learn about it, and they tried to suppress it. But what I was told was, you know, once they realized there was thousands of copies, they essentially tried to get Bill Clawdon to accept a bribe of sorts. You know, they wanted him to come out and say, hey, I recant this, I was wrong, you know, this is not what happened. And the reason I got some of that information is because in addition to this main tape, this VHS, which again, most of the people are dead, which is unfortunate because I was trying to track them down, like, hey, do you still stand by what you said? Do you have anything else to add to this? You know, without that knowledge, and there may be forthcoming, I've actually been able to get in touch with some more people who produced the original full-length interviews, and they still have copies of them. They're in the process of being digitized. So I'm going to be poring over those to see if there's any more information that could, you know, lead to somebody who's still alive and can confirm these things, which is my main goal, not just to add to rumors and salacious, you know, details, but how can we actually try to find justice if these things happened? But the other piece of this sort of Gordon B. Hinckley puzzle, besides the hunters, which is a whole other part, is that I was sent the testimony of a man named Daryl Clegg, and we put this in the first part of my article. Daryl Clegg was friends with Bill Clawdon, the lead investigator. He also was a former member of the church living in Utah. And in 2014, Daryl Clegg, essentially, he did this short interview with a journalist who chose to remain anonymous and gave his sort of last will and testimony of, here's what I remember, here's what I know. I was there, I met the witnesses, I attended the meeting when Gordon B. Hinckley's attorney came to try to shut Bill Clawdon down. And I, you know, he recounts the story of meeting the attorney, and the attorney, once they told him that there was thousands of copies of the film, he throws his hands up in the air and says, okay, well, you know, what's it going to take to get you to shut up about this? It just was clearly there was some effort to suppress this. And this probably was a lot easier before the internet and, you know, things like this just getting put out there. So I think that maybe some copies just, you know, things get lost over time. They got lost to the pages of history, and they've only now recently come back with the story. Bill, Daryl Clegg, though, he asked the person who recorded his interview to not release it until after his death. Mm-hmm. He died in 2017. And then, you know, I guess once I started investigating this, the person who had the copies of the tape thought, hey, you know what, maybe it's time to get this out there. And so it was sent to us. And so, you know, overall, we have a tape with five different individuals making claims. Bill Clawdon, the lead investigator, saying at the time when he was alive that he had sworn testimonies, affidavits from each of these witnesses. He was challenging the church to take him to court to prove, you know, like, hey, if you think I'm lying, let's go to court and I'll bring what I got. And we also have Daryl Clegg, who was friends with Bill Clawdon, lead investigator, claiming in the last couple years of his life, this is true, this is what I witnessed, these things were accurate. And there's also, you know, was discussions that some of the prostitutes were, at least one or two of them, which, you know, difficult to find these people at this point if they're still alive, but one prostitute known as Chrissy was found dead under a bridge in Salt Lake City shortly after some of this stuff started to get discussed. So Daryl Clegg was afraid for his life, and the full recording that we have, you know, he says several times, like, I don't know, they could still be looking for me, things like that. So that's probably why he was saying, like, can you wait till I'm dead? Cause I don't want any trouble. But yeah, that's what we have so far.
Well, there is an additional line of information that comes from the daughters of one of the Hunter brothers that owned this car lot, right? They wrote a book called, or one of them wrote a book called Deliver Us from Evil, talking about how Walton Hunter would molest his own kids and his grandkids, and that they were instructed, like, hey, like, don't ever leave the grandkids alone with grandpa or something bad will happen. And of course that did happen, and something bad did happen, and the kid that was molested wound up growing up and later having big problems and eventually overdosed on drugs as a result, potentially as a result of dealing and trying to sort out, you know, what happens when you get molested. This is unfortunately not an uncommon story, but it adds a little bit more credibility here. What did you ever have a chance to talk to the daughters that wrote these books, or I mean, because they were escaping from mere generalizations. They were like, this is exactly what he did, and this is how they. I mean, they laid it out there, right?
Yeah. So initially when we published this investigation, which we called Justice Delayed, it was just two parts. It was everything I just covered about Gordon B. Hinckley and the tape, and then what we're about to discuss now about the Hunter's daughters. And within days of us publishing that, I finally was able to get in touch with Deborah Hunter Marsh, who is the one of the daughters, and then Rebecca Kapp, who's the other daughter. And so the third piece of Justice Delayed actually quotes from them directly. And they, yeah, that's when they confirmed everything, because they, so as you said, we have the Hunt, we have Gordon B. Hinckley and the Hunters, brothers, bishops in the church. And before we published our investigation, I decided, like, I need to listen to this tape one more time, make sure we didn't miss anything. And I also will make sure this is clear. We sent a request for comment to the Mormon Church leadership and media team several times before we published this as well, to let them know we were going to be releasing this. I also sent these stories to every single outlet in the Salt Lake City area. And so far, none of them have followed up with it. Yeah, we didn't expect anything, but just so you know, we're doing our due diligence to give them a chance to say anything. But yeah, so I listened to the tape again, and one of the witnesses says something to the effect that, oh, well, I think Walton Hunter was given his bishopship because of his friendship with Gordon B. Hinckley. And so that kind of piqued my interest. It's like, okay, if this guy was a bishop in the church, then there's got to be a record of him. That could be, you know, clues to something else. That's just usually where my mind's going when I'm deep down these investigations. You know, anything could be a break. And in this case, it sort of did open up some new doors, because I started researching Walton Hunter and I find his obituary. And yet they mentioned he was a bishop in Salt Lake City at the time of these allegations regarding these sex parties. He was also a bishop in San Diego Mormon Church. And, you know, this pay tribute to him, this and that. They mentioned, well, he leaves behind a couple of daughters. So I start looking up family members, just looking for any clues. And sure enough, that's what led me to his daughter, Deborah Hunter Marsh, her book, Deliver Us From Evil, which was sort of like quietly, silently co-written with her sister, Rebecca, who didn't want to be as vocal. But when I reached out to her for this investigation, and she did tell me that her son, who they referred to as Alex in the book, who was abused by his grandfather, that he did end up dying of an overdose. The mother basically said she didn't want to speak up when he was alive because she didn't want to, like, you know, torment him more. But I guess she's kind of at a point now where, like, you know, my son is dead. And to what you said earlier, the mom absolutely believes that his overdose was the result of everything he's dealt with, all the trauma he's dealt with in his life since being abused by his grandfather. So yeah, I mean, now they're a little more willing to speak. Deborah Hunter, who is the main force behind the book, she's in an assisted living home. She's not in the greatest of health, but, you know, I kind of was able, I felt good to let her know, like, hey, we're, for whatever it's worth, this was a self-published book in 2014. Most people never heard of it, never seen it, but to let her know, hey, your story is getting out here. You know, I know that's not justice, doesn't take away anything, but again, that's why I write about this. Some people might be like, this is 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago accusations, you know, what does it matter? I don't care about the church, but I care about these cases, whether it's the salacious stuff with Prince Andrew and Epstein and this and that or whatever. It's like, it's the fact that this is happening, and it happens within different institutions where authority preys on young kids. And I think if we don't talk about it, and also the fact that the Mormon Church clearly, in my view, based on what I've found, was involved in trying to suppress this at the very least, because prior to us publishing this investigation and these reports, I mean, you can't find any copy of this tape anywhere on the internet of the accusations against Gordon B. Hinckley. Like, I found one or two references on it on exmormons.org, which is pretty, you know, niche ex-Mormon community forums. Like, and they don't even have the right title for it. They just sort of, it's like this mythological object. There used to be a tape about Gordon B. Hinckley, right? So there was clearly some effort to keep this information out. And I think the same thing goes for the case of Walton Hunter and his story. Again, the obituary talks about how he was such a great man. He brought in the youth to the church and this and that. And meanwhile, his daughters are saying, no, this is a pedophile. This is a, you know, a rapist, an abuser. He was raping, you know, his daughter, Deborah Hunter Marsh. And he was, I don't know if he full on raped Rebecca, but he definitely was sexually abusing her. And the other thing is, the mother was fully aware this was going on. The both daughters say there's no way the mom couldn't have seen the blood on the sheets or the stains, bodily fluids. Another incident in the book, which, I'll be honest, man. I mean, this isn't my first go around in this sort of story, Epstein, the finders, Franklin scandal, et cetera. But the book brought me to tears. You know, I was reading it overnight, just like, all right, I need to find, is there any information here worth reporting and any details I missed? And yeah, just reading her story, describing everything she went through, it did mess me up, you know, especially like Rebecca describing, you know, most of it is Deborah describing her story, but then there's a chapter where Rebecca describes her story, where they describe what happened to this, the grandson, and then, you know, some other, so they kind of break it down into sections. And Rebecca talks about, like, when she started to get abused by her father, Walton Hunter, that there was a night where he walked in and I think he was trying to get, you know, oral sex from his daughter, and the mom walks in and doesn't say anything, just slams the door and calls her a slut and leaves, you know? And so the mom was playing a role in it. And, you know, so the book goes into telling their story, and essentially, yeah, this kind of ended up branching off and I think adding more credibility to the claims that were already being lobbed, not only against Gordon B. Hinckley, but against the Hunters, that they were there at these parties. Well, now it's not just five people saying they witnessed these parties back in the 60s. It's this man's own daughter saying that he was coming home and raping them. And even though they don't specifically name Gordon B. Hinckley by name in the book, after I spoke with Deborah and Rebecca when we started publishing this, they both said they believed the accusations against Gordon B. Hinckley are true. And they said that and more. We were confident more happened. They also said that they don't think there's any way that Gordon B. Hinckley and other people who are so close to their dad in the church couldn't have known that their father was abusing them. Like, they're like, we believe that other people fully knew about this. And they also, I mean, to someone who's like, oh, this is just, you know, her word versus theirs, in her book, and I put this in the third part of the article, that she has letters from her, once she, as an adult, started to see a therapist, like, hey, I need to talk to somebody about these issues. You know, she said it was like, you know, just, it became a thing. She couldn't have romantic relations with people as an adult. So she started to go see a therapist to talk about it. Well, the therapist wrote letters to address to her mother, June Walton, and Walton Hunter, her father, saying, please come sit down and let's talk with your daughter about this. And so she publishes the letters, the back and forth between her therapist and her parents basically saying, you've brainwashed our daughter. We're not going to come. This is, you know, BS, this and that. And she also shows that eventually, once her family moved from Salt Lake City and they went to San Diego, then as adults, you know, they decide, like, you know what, we're going to do something. We, like, our dad needs to be stopped. Like, they decided, like, they wanted to come after him. They got him excommunicated from his second position. And again, the obituary doesn't mention, oh, by the way, his second bishopship, he was excommunicated for accusations of raping his own daughters. Like, they don't mention that. But the book shows the letter from the, what they call the stake president, who kind of makes the decision. And the women, Rebecca and Deborah, describe having to go sit down, like, face to face with their dad and, like, call him out. I guess that's how they do things. It's like a disciplinary council. And so they had to tell their story in front of 12 men and their father and just, like, you know, call them out. And they were successful in getting him excommunicated. They also attempted to do a civil lawsuit, which I linked to that in the article. You can find that. There's court records of this. It does exist. I'm in the copy of getting the actual transcripts just to see if there's anything else in there. So, you know, we have corroboration that this isn't just some woman making things up. It's two daughters in the family. And unfortunately, they say it did split their family up. They have a brother and sister who think that they're liars and that they ruined the family by accusing dad, and mom and dad are both gone now. I will say, you know, for whatever it's worth, that they also report that in their father's last days that he tried to claim at different points in their life. He claimed, I just got another revelation. You know, this is a part of the church. You know, I got a revelation. And the angels said, I've forgiven for all the things that I've done in my life. And they're just like, okay, dad, you know, just whatever. But then in the last few days of his life, he was telling his wife, and the wife shared with the daughters, that he was starting to be surrounded by what he said were dark figures and was just getting really frightened and terrified towards, you know, his last moments.
Good.
Yeah.
He should. You know, I'll tell you, I'm watching that video, the true story of Mormon President Gordon B. Hinckley, and because it's the topic, and because it's the video quality and the timing that it's made, in my mind, I'm going to Conspiracy of Silence with, like, all the Franklin kids and Paul Bonacci and those interviews, and it was like very sort of like almost interchangeable between them. But you mentioned that the Mormon Church, you know, being accused of sort of covering this up. They're more than just accused of covering this up. They have set up what you wrote about, a helpline, which was really very deep, if you're trying to cover it up, very smart and devious at the same time. So that they would instruct people, don't call the cops, call the helpline, right? And then we're going to, and we'll get to the bottom of this, but that helpline helped to, like, first of all, identify anybody that might call the cops and draw them into a new psychological operation where they can be told that they didn't see what they saw or didn't, whatever. But can we talk about a little bit about the helpline? Like, what was that used? Like, how did they misuse that?
Yeah. So and this is another reason why I thought that it was worth to, you know, once we received this tape, you know, at first it's like, what do we have? We started going through it. I realized we had something worth writing about, but it was also important for me to write about this in the historical context and putting that into what's going on now. Right. So if this was happening back then and there was attempts to cover it up, perhaps it would happen. It's still happening now. And then literally the week I'm publishing my investigation, the Associated Press appeared to do some actual reporting, and they published a report about this helpline. And it essentially, it confirms that, yes, the Mormon Church is still being plagued, like many of the major religions, with sexual abuse going on within the church. And not only that, but church members actively covering it up. And so it's kind of a weird instance too, because not only is the man who their story focused on, this pedophile, he was a member of the Mormon Church, but he was also a Border Patrol agent for the U.S. government in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So interestingly enough, right? And so this guy seemed to be self-aware enough, at least based on the reporting, that he recognized he had that he liked children. He is the true definition of a pedophile. He was attracted to young children. And he, I guess, went to his bishop and tried to say, hey, like, I have this problem. I've been abusing my daughter. I'm addicted to porn and this and that. And the bishop went to the helpline, as he'd been instructed to do, said, hey, I got a guy coming to me, sharing testimony, claiming this. And the helpline, as you mentioned, it's staffed by attorneys. So it's not like you're going to like mental health experts or anything like that. It's like, okay, the attorneys, and they're like, okay, hey, we need to watch this one. Let's make sure this one doesn't get out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's meant to stifle anything from reaching the public, and they can kind of control and micromanage how they're going to handle different things like this, like accusations of sexual abuse. And so essentially what happened is the lawyers told him, well, this confession came to you during, I can't remember what they call it, but it's essentially, you know, confession, like with Catholics, but it's mm-hmm. their sacred thing, right? And so they're like, because of that, you're legally bound. You can't report this because it came to you in that form. So instead, they were just like, counsel him to, you know, keep praying and this and that, and talk to the wife and see if you can get her to intervene. They, you know, basically told him, do anything besides like report this and contact the cops. And so essentially the abuse goes on for another 7 years. So this young girl, all the way up till she's like 14 or 15, she's being abused by her dad. And the just messed up part of it all, man, is that in that time, the wife, again, I think it maybe is the wife's being submissive to the husbands or whatever. Maybe the husbands are abusive to them, because this is another case, just like the one I described, where the mom didn't make any effort to stop. The mom like actively mm-hmm. knew the husband was doing this. So the mom gets pregnant while this abuse of the first daughter is going on. The second daughter's born, and according to these reports, he starts abusing her within 2 weeks of her being born, dude. I mean, like, just sickening stuff, you know? And not only that, he's videotaping this stuff. He's videotaping it and apparently uploading it to, you know, pedo chats and deep web or somewhere, right? And so that goes on for, the whole abuse goes on for 7 years, and then for at least the first few years of this other young baby's entire life, essentially being abused by her father. The only reason this stopped, it had nothing to do with the Mormon Church finally saying, hey, we need to go do something about this, because the husband would come back and say, hey, I'm still having a problem. Maybe he's really battling himself, and some part of him had a soul still and was like, hey, please help me, I can't help myself. Whatever happened, the church kept it within their helpline, within their dominion, and it never got out. The only reason this man ended up being arrested and in this came out through a lawsuit, that these facts came out through a lawsuit against the church, was that a different pedo in New Zealand, he gets arrested, farmer out there, got a bunch of child porn on his phone. He gets arrested. They start going through his phone and trying to track down where these videos are coming from. One of those videos happened to be of the Arizona man, the Mormon, abusing his daughters in the phone, you know, the recordings he made. So Interpol gets involved, they track him down, Border Patrol, he's arrested, et cetera. That case is ongoing. But again, the Mormon Church did nothing to stop the abuse. They directed it to the helpline, and they've since the Associated Press published this, and you know, the word has gotten out and more people are talking about it, they've published like what they think is a debunking of these claims, mm-hmm. stating that, you know, they did everything they could and this and that. And, you know, for whoever wants to see that, that's on their website and their press releases.
Jesus. What's the, we mentioned this earlier, the PACE memos. What was the, yeah. what's the details of the PACE memos? That seemed rather important.
Yeah, so this was part, I think it was the fourth part of my initial five-part investigation, which was, again, a response to the sheriff's announcement in June that they were going to, one second, it looks like my camera might be dying soon, unfortunately. I haven't seen the flash. Okay. I thought this thing was charged. Apologies for that. I'm going to keep going. Sorry to cut that out. But yeah, so the PACE memo came, the reason I became aware of that is because I was investigating the Utah Sheriff's Office investigation into ritual abuse. That's ongoing. That's happening 2022, not historical. That happened just 4 months ago. And as far as we know, I've been texting with the sheriff's office. They're still investigating it. They haven't made any arrests or any subpoenas or any indictments. So we'll see what happens. But as I was researching that, I started to take a bigger picture and say, well, what's going on in Utah? I looked into the history of Utah and found that there's examples of cults and ritual abuse going back, you know, decades in Utah. And then I looked specifically at these accusations within the Mormon church. And so there's more than a few, the PACE memo being one of the big ones. I think it might be big enough where it has a Wikipedia page telling you that it was debunked and it's fake and, you know, nothing to believe here, just part of that whole satanic panic. But a man named Glenn PACE, he was known as in the position called the general authority in the church. He wrote this memo in 1990 to the church leadership and said that it was based on him interviewing 60 members of the church who had complaints going back several years, claiming that they had been forced to participate in different rituals, which were sometimes referred to as satanic. And he said, quote, "I've met with 60 victims. That number could be twice or three times as many if I did not discipline myself to only one meeting per week. I have not wanted my involvement with this issue to become a handicap in fulfilling my assigned responsibilities. On the other hand, I felt someone needed to pay the price to obtain an intellectual and spiritual conviction as to the seriousness of this problem within the church." And so, yeah, he said that this abuse was taking place in Utah, Idaho, California, and Mexico. And the former president before Gordon B. Hinckley, Ezra Taft Benson, he had been notified about this. And PACE claimed that, according to his investigation, at least 800 members of the church were involved or had knowledge of this abuse, including bishops, presidents, patriarchs, temple workers, members of the young women and men groups, and members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir were all involved in this, he claimed. Yeah, and so it made some mainstream news. There's like a Chicago Tribune report. I think the New York Times might have covered it once or twice. But pretty quickly, like most of these things, it was dismissed and determined to be fake news, you know, satanic panic. Nobody believed him. But Glenn PACE, till his death, maintained that what he found was accurate. And you know, that's just one example. I mean, the article, I'll send you this one if you want to link to it, but I go into a couple other examples. I mean, there's a book that came out called Paper Dolls that was published anonymously. And that, you know, some people think that what was described in Paper Dolls, which is also these sex parties involving adults and rituals, you know, organized groups, that actually involves the current leadership of the Mormon church, the president in power right now. And so that's like why that's even more a little controversial for some people. That there was a case about that a year ago that got thrown out of court. And unfortunately, I learned through the course of this investigation, the Utah Supreme Court in the last couple of years, they issued a precedent that pretty much shut down a lot of these cases because of statute of limitations. So they effectively made it a lot harder for people to pursue justice in this department.
Well, okay, so we're not going to be able to pursue, or it's going to be more difficult to pursue justice with regard to satanic ritual abuse or these things that are obviously kept dark, you know, deeply under wraps. But can we go the Al Capone route? Can we get them on money laundering? I mean,
I think there's probably some of that going on for sure. I mean, anybody who studied this, as I know you have, and probably folks in your audience, from the Franklin scandal to the Finders, there's a lot of interesting connections, not only to intelligence communities, but I have definitely been told by a number of sources that the Mormon church is a recruiting ground for CIA and for the FBI. Yes. And, you know, we know, of course, their ties to organized crime and things of this sort. So I that's what I was saying earlier. I mean, I think maybe some of us are sleeping on how powerful the Mormon church really is.
Yeah. Well, I lived in Las Vegas for 10 years, and about 10% of the population in Las Vegas is Mormon. I had no idea when I first moved there that it was that big of a population. But then I heard early on people say, oh, yeah, the Mormons are way connected to the CIA. You know, they go on missions. They're all over the place. They're told, you know, if you see something, say something, like Janet Napolitano would tell you. And I thought, oh, God, yeah, that's interesting aspect to that that I never thought. But then, of course, the intelligence agencies would be all over that. I see that your camera dropped off. Are you still there?
I'm still here. Sorry.
All right, we'll keep going in audio format because this goes out as audio. So everybody that's watching, you're going to have to just imagine Derek's handsome face. He's there, but we've only got about 15 minutes left. So what did we find anything like concrete that ties ties Mormons to? Well, look, if you get tied to the CIA, then you're automatically talking about money laundering. We know that. When you've got a religious exemption that prevents you from having to pay taxes, my guess is that a lot of mystery money flows into your church disguised as church money only to flow out somewhere else. So what do we know about the Mormons church's money situation?
Well, again, I do know that their land holdings are quite large. You know, to the specifics of the case, these cases here, I will mention one incident, which I don't think I've gotten to the bottom of. There's actually, two different elements. One of them involves the hunters, which we were just talking about. And in the book, Deliver Us From Evil, there's a point where Deborah discusses how they had to pick up and move pretty quickly. You know, we know that Walton was living in Salt Lake City. This is the time when he was accused of being involved in those parties. And we don't really know why he left, but the book describes, Deborah Hunter's book describes that she remembers being a young girl and just picking up rapidly, leaving town, and that there was some sort of money involved, that her dad was like really stressed out. So I don't know if that was money laundering, because he definitely was accused of it. I mean, this, without getting too in the weeds, the guy, Charles Van Dam, who accused Gordon B. Hinckley of the homosexual relationship, he says that he was actually handed a bunch of cash from the Hunters or Gordon B. Hinckley to go pay for the house, you know, that they would use for the sex parties. And there was some money, some cash floating around. So this is what Deborah says. She says checks for $75,000 or more were cashed. I also remember mother and father bemoaning the fact that all of dad's cars on both car lots were stolen overnight, which is kind of crazy. By whom, I'm not sure, but they mentioned Chuck Van Dam's as a possible thief. My parents were extremely upset after this. You know, we picked up and we moved. We moved just across town. And so she described just this like sudden change. And she said, we loaded up our car with a few of our clothes, a few personal items, and we left in the middle of the night to move to California, leaving behind important large or bulk personal items such as scrapbooks, furniture, etc. We took only what we could fit in two automobiles. Our parents didn't tell us why. We just had to move. So I don't know what exactly that situation is describing, but knowing what we know and what Charles Van Dam was saying about the money being passed to him, it could be some sort of, you know, washing of money via the church. You know, something is happening there. And then the other component, I will say, as far as the initial investigation that really started all of my work on this, the Utah County Sheriff's investigation into ritualized child sex abuse, you know, that is a whole nother can of worms. But what I will say about that is that one of the men who inserted himself into that investigation is Utah County Attorney David Levitt. And again, as I learned, is these families, these names, you see these names pop up a lot. The Levitts, David Levitt, his brother was Mike Levitt, who's the governor of Utah, former governor of Utah. Their father's Dixie Levitt. He owns like Levitt insurance broker firms, one of the most powerful insurance companies in Utah, maybe in the US. And then they also run the Levitt Foundation, which coincidentally has been in Ukraine since 2014, promoting democracy and fighting human trafficking, they claim.
Interesting. So you're in Ukraine. You're in Ukraine fighting human trafficking while covering up human trafficking inside of Utah. It sounds about right.
It's exactly, because this man David Levitt, he is the county attorney, and in his position, which he recently voted out, so come January he'll just be a regular old citizen, and we'll see what's going to happen, because he's already under suspicion for potential human trafficking charges related to an adoption of a young Native American girl that he facilitated for his family. And this has all been reported in the last couple months. And he's, you know, still trying to claim, he called the sheriff who announced this investigation a QAnon sheriff, trying to do, you know, just deflect. But the facts that we know is that David Levitt has had business in Ukraine. He told this reservation in Montana, hey, I have connections in Ukraine. You guys got a bunch of buffalo. Well, look, I can facilitate an exchange. Maybe they'll buy your buffalo. You help me get this adoption, you know, sweeten the deal. The adoption happened. I don't know if Ukraine has the buffalo, but he's on record, literally on a videotape, which has become public, admitting this and sort of telling the story how he sweetened the deal so he could get this. So at the least, he bent some rules to make an adoption happen. but potentially it could be a human trafficking charge for the way he went after it. And then in addition to that, once this whole recent Ukraine, you know, debacle started, there's local news reports in Salt Lake City. David Levitt heads to Utah, says he needs to go to his apartment to get some of his things before, you know, war breaks out. So I don't know exactly what he is facilitating there, but I'm not convinced that I or any of us have got to the bottom of what the Levitt Foundation is doing. And yes, this is the same man who, as county attorney in Utah, shut down the Special Victims Unit, which specifically investigates child trafficking and sex abuse. He also, after the sheriffs announced their investigation, he inserted his foot in the mouth by holding a press conference saying, me and my wife are not cannibals or murderers, because apparently him and his wife, he believes, are listed in these documents. I mean, it was like a really, like, what the heck, where is this coming from? What's going on in Utah? And so I say all that to say that surely there is money laundering, there is trafficking going on, and there is these intelligence connections that I'm, you know, it's kind of why I've just been like knee deep in Utah the past few months, because people keep sending me more information. But not only that, Charlie, but I mentioned earlier that just this week, NBC News published these two hit pieces, one called Satanic Panic is Making a Comeback, Fueled by QAnon Believers and GOP Influencers. And it literally spends 15 paragraphs defending this guy, David Levitt, that I was just describing, and makes no mention that he's under investigation for potential human trafficking, but that he, you know, has lied multiple times. I've documented all this in my articles for TLAV and in my videos and such, but essentially tries to make it claim like, oh, this is just some YouTube videos making accusations against him. And so he's had to come out and defend himself. And they wait till about 10 paragraphs down to say, oh yeah, by the way, this is due to a new case from the Utah County Sheriff investigating ritualistic child sexual abuse. You know, but the point is clear that they want people to associate any of these concerns with QAnon insanity, your, you know, satanic panic, you're just some scared conservative, you're out of touch with reality. But there's a lot more here than they want us to believe.
Yeah. Okay, fine. We won't associate it with those other things. We'll just associate it with Warren Jeffs. How about that? Right? Because that's a guy we don't need to speculate or do any sort of researching into the FLDS fundamentalist Latter-day Saints church that Warren Jeffs ran, church, I guess, being sort of optional, more like a cult, more like a sex party recruiting tool for him. This guy was a real piece of garbage. Now, I fully recognize that he broke off and sort of, he's sort of like a branch on the LDS tree, but not necessarily part of the main trunk of it. What were the connections of Warren Jeffs to the, I mean, obviously he's got all the hallmarks. He's got sex with children, abuse, cult-like behavior, EBT card thefts, and running that whole scam that he was doing. I mean, he's a full-blown criminal. We know that. But what were the sort of, were there some overlaps between what Warren Jeffs was involved with, or the people he was involved with, and the people that are involved in this alleged satanic panic story that we're hearing about now?
Well, I do think that what they try to do is conflate these things, right? So it's okay to say that some offshoot weirdo Warren Jeffs was up to some nasty things, but that's not part of the main Mormon church. And those things only happen in isolation. That doesn't, you know, there's no coordinated groups of people doing that, which is what the Utah County Sheriff's is investigating at the moment, right? And that's essentially what Paper Dolls makes the accusation of. That's what Glenn Pace's memo talked about. And, you know, even the accusations that we've been focusing on today against Gordon B. Hinckley and Walton Hunter, I don't think that those should be considered in isolation, right? Because if these things are going on at home and at these sex parties, and I'm sure there's other incidents of that, right? So that's it. I've just noticed that, like, it's okay to say, yes, sexual abuse of a child can happen in isolation. But the moment you start to consider the possibility that there's some coordination going on, or that there's organized groups of this, then that's when you've, you know, according to the mainstream, veered off into satanic panic, you know, moral outrage. There's just, you know, calm down. There's nothing going on. There's no agendas here. But when it comes to Warren Jeffs specifically, you know, again, I interviewed lots of current and former Mormons who some have very strong opinions. You may have come across this. Some people believe from the very beginning, the Mormon church under Joseph Smith was actually working with the Freemasons. So for those who go down that road, there's a lot of similarity between the handshakes and some of the artwork and things that are going on. If you look at the LDS buildings in Salt Lake City and elsewhere, There's, you know, people ask questions like, why are there not any crosses on these buildings, right? That why is right. Jesus's name not mentioned these prayers? Different things that lead some people to believe that what the, at least at the top level of the Mormon church are really worshiping or believing is something different than what the flock is being taught, right? And so along with that, there, you know, you look to what Joseph Smith, the founder of the church, he started, it was a polygamist from the beginning, you know, so the whole thing involved polygamy. So you can't really totally, at least in my view, separate what Warren Jeffs was doing from the church altogether, right? Because it does have a history of that. And also the church has a history of things like blood atonement, you know, blood sacrifices. That is absolutely 100% not a conspiracy, not a theory, but existed in the early days of the church. And some said still do exist. And those things were encouraged and apparently being practiced under Warren Jeffs. You know, and even the fact that Warren Jeffs has gone to prison, is in prison right now. For those who haven't seen, there's, you know, a documentary and some book, lots of books out there. I think Keep Sweet Obey is one of the, something like that. Keep Sweet Pray and Obey something. Mm-hmm. But there, you know, there's lots of work that can dissect it. But what I think they've failed to do is to point out that this man has never been fully charged for everything that he's done. You know, right. he's gotten lesser charges because his own children accuse him of raping them. You know, one of them has committed suicide. I think, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, Brent maybe, wrote a book all about this. So, I mean, this was clearly organized, you know, like you said, to call what he was doing a church is a huge stretch because it became very much a cult around Warren Jeffs. And he himself picked up that cult from his father, Roland Jeffs, you know, so again, the Jeffs family goes back to the beginning of the founding of the Mormon church. So I don't know if the average Mormon is connected to that church, but I would say the idea that there's no connection between these groups in any way is probably a stretch.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up on this. What do we know about the current president, Russell M. Nelson? My guess is that, like any of these things, you don't rise to positions of prominence without being part of the club. So my guess is he's part of the club. Is he embroiled in this whole current thing, or is he being kept out of it?
So he is... I can't prove this at the moment. I don't know if anybody has camped. He is believed to have been one of the people anonymously named in paper dolls. So he's currently the president, but the paper dolls story, which was what I was saying earlier, is like this story of these two women anonymously telling their story of a woman and her husband. And we don't know who they are, but the suspicion is that it's the current president's daughter and brother and son-in-law. And I do think that this is probably true, at least that the accusations against them are who they're pointing at, because I also point in one of my articles that just in the last 2 years, there was a lawsuit that was anonymously filed by someone in Salt Lake City that was naming the current president's Nelson, his daughter and his son-in-law as defendants. And so the case was very much like kept secret, but what it appears to be is this was somebody that was trying to bring, again, the paper dolls claims, which was made back in the 90s, to the legal system. And actually Russell Nelson himself, the current president, was named as a witness. And they said specifically like, hey, we're not accusing him of anything, but if this case goes forward, we're going to call him as a witness. And so, you know, that seems to indicate that there was at least accusations going on. So I do think and I've been told by other sources, they're like, hey, just FYI, that's what paper dolls is referring to. Nobody can prove that yet. And the man, again, is, as the current president, he's seen like a prophet, just like Gordon B. Hinckley. So any accusations against him are fought pretty vehemently from the faithful and the Mormon church.
What a scam, right? You rise to the position of president, then you call yourself, you transform into a prophet who is above reproach so that you're not even human anymore. So how could you be bound by these human laws and all this? What a devious scam these people have running. I mean, look, I'm not into organized religion. Believe whatever you want. You know, I mean, it's not my job to get into what people believe, but as long as you're not hurting somebody else, it's none of my business. But a lot of these organized religions, what you find is that they are hurting other people, and usually it's the most vulnerable. It's the most disgusting component of this is what they do to the kids, and that abuse, of course, lasts forever. And we've had, just during this conversation, we've mentioned on multiple occasions, talking about victims that wind up killing themselves or overdosing or whatever. I mean, this is very common. It's disgusting. Your work on the Finders is great. I had John Brisson back on here to talk about that, the Franklin scandal. I mean, I think you're doing some of the best work out there, man. I really mean that. So I wish none of us had to worry about this stuff, but because it's out there, because it exists in this world that we live in, can't avoid it. Let's not be the wife in these situations that just pretends that the abuse isn't going on. No, let's kick the doors down. Let's make some noise. Let's hold these people accountable and do that. Derek, where's the best place for people to connect with you and find your work?
Well, thank you again, brother, for having me on. I appreciate the platform, and thanks for all the work that you continue to do. I really do appreciate it. My work, most of my video reports, my documentaries, my articles, the books and stuff I've published, all that is at theconsciousresistance.com. And then for my kind of ongoing investigations, those are published at The Last American Vagabond. Ryan has a navigation page. You can find my articles and Whitney's articles just right at the top, navigation.
Yep. You guys are doing outstanding work. Whitney's on too. Just recorded her. By the time this episode is out, people will have already heard the Whitney Webb interview where she talks about the two books that she's written. Of course, The Last American Vagabond is the best place, in my opinion, to find this information. That's Derek Bros, everybody. Please support his work. Follow him wherever you can. If you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. And you can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggression, the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody.
Night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.